You're listening to the Banana Data Podcast, a podcast hosted by Data IQ. I'm Trevaini.
And I'm Will.
And we'll be taking you behind the curtain of the AI hype, exploring what it is
and what it isn't
capable of. Today, we're talking about polling, asking how to handle messy data, how to manage data for the public, and what any data scientist can learn from the work of pollsters. So with us today is Grace Turk-Martinez, Analytics Director at Messina Group. Welcome to the show, Grace. We'd love to know a little bit more about your backstory, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm the Analytics Director at the Messina Group. We are a small consulting firm in DC, and we work with a variety of political and corporate clients. But our background, so it's kind of all in our name. Jim Messina was the campaign manager of the 2012 Obama campaign. So we all kind of come out of that political background. And so I do data and analytics for the firm, which means, you know, sort of bringing that political background to bear, but also working on different types of projects. And really, I got into this field because I got my master's in social science at the University of Chicago, thinking that I wanted to get my PhD in political science and become an academic. Actually sounded like you work really hard for many years and don't make any money. And I didn't know that political data was even a thing. And then I found it and I was like, this is perfect. I really like math and statistics. And I found that I really enjoyed coding. And hey, I could use all of those skills and apply it to something that I found was really interesting and impactful in the real world. So that's kind of how I got into this space. And
so we're going to talk today about this article that Will actually found it and sent it to me. For folks listening in, right, there is a well-known sort of polling data expert known as Nate Silver. I'm sure you've seen his 538 blogs. He does a lot of predictions with presidential races and the like. And recently, there's been a bit of a back and forth between him and another famous statistician named Nassim Taleb. Nassim Taleb is arguing that the predictions by Nate Silver's blogs are not true predictions, right? They're really more probability estimates. And it's an interesting sort of statistical question. But I think given that we have Grace here with us, it might be more interesting to talk a little bit about the questions around data quality and issues with actual polling data or data when you're collecting it from humans who are known to have errors.
Yeah, most people who work in data science often have issues with, hey, we don't have the perfect data set. There's data that's missing. There's data we have a question about where it came from. Because political work is so people-oriented, it's just really fraught with questions about, hey, there's missing information. How accurate is this? You can ask people a question in a survey and they might not even know how they feel about something. So there are so many ways that it can be difficult to measure and collect information just to begin with. You throw all of the difficulty of, you know, forecasting and campaigning into that and things can get messy. So I think in my job, what I see is something that's really important to like the type of work that I do is figuring out, hey, how do we deal with this messy data and turn it into something that we can actually use? Because we're never going to get perfect data. That's not going to happen. It's more about, hey, what do we have available and how can we make the best use out of it?
Yeah, I think that distinction between the data you have and then what you do with it is a good delineation. The way I understand Nate Silver and 538's work is that they're looking at individual polls. And so you think of poll as some sort of data collection mechanism, but then they're applying their own statistical methods in aggregating those polls and trying to account for historical biases. So I think like no matter what, that's such an interesting thought to me, which is A, optimize the quality of your data, like make sure your poll is not biased, make sure your poll is as accurate as possible. But then as a separate goal, take whatever data you have, try to understand, is it high quality, is it low quality? And then with an understanding of its quality, how do you use it to the best of your ability?
Yeah. And I think how most people are using this information is more like, hey, what's going on? What's the state of the race? So yeah, I really like 538. I'm a fan. I am a fan of Nate Silver. So I'll just be honest about that. What they're trying to do is just, hey, we have a ton of different polls. Let's aggregate them and try to, you know, even out some of that noise to get a better sense of where we are.
Like, I like what you said about also kind of thinking about the goal. I'm going to say 538's goal, like their stated goal, as far as I can tell, is just saying, hey, this is kind of our assessment of the probability or the likelihood of a certain outcome. It's the data collection and the analysis because ultimately you want some other outcome and you're interested in the information that this gives you in shaping that outcome.
Yeah, totally. You know, when you're working on a campaign or you're working for an organization, you're trying to figure out, okay, I'm making measurements so that I can decide what I'm going to do. Who am I going to talk to? What sort of investments do I need to make to get to a place where I'm going to be able to win? That means you need to persuade people to support you, and you need to get those supporters out to the polls on election day. The data that you collect from surveys is a little different from polling, but based on data. So I think that can be a pretty big difference in terms of, you know, when you think about like public polling versus what practitioners are usually doing with the data.
Yeah, I think there's that big distinction because public polling is really focused on giving you some sort of quick stat, maybe more general public. But for folks like yourself, and I think a lot of data scientists and analysts in many industries, the whole goal is to really be able to take that data and actually get some meaning out of it, right? Not just a single prediction number or a probability. Oftentimes, you are dealing with data that you didn't have the opportunity to collect, that you know is inherently flawed. You couldn't do all of the good front-end, back-end stuff. What do you do through the process of your analytics? This isn't a problem specific to the political polling data, right? This is a problem mm-hmm. we're going to see in every industry.
So, you know, we oftentimes are gathering data and then pairing it back to a big data source that we have that we call the consumer file. It's a database of 270 million American adults, and it's aggregated from many different sources. So much in there that I'm not even aware of everything that exists in that data set. So dealing with that type of data is pretty difficult because it's not an ideal data source. It's not perfect. There's many problems with it that we know about, but it's also so much better than not having that data. There is no better alternative.
You're talking about this massive data you have and the quality of it. One thing that also always strikes me, particularly about political data, though it's relevant to other areas as well, is like when you're explicitly asking human beings for their input versus inferring, you know, their perceptions or their beliefs or their future behaviors from something that's not an explicit question that you're asking them. So a similar analogy would be to me, sometimes when you're using software online, right, they're trying to create a net promoter score and they pop up bubble says like, hey, how much do you like this software, this tool? So that's the equivalent to me of a pollster saying, hey, are you going to vote for candidate A or candidate B, which is maybe reliable, as opposed to they could see how much time I spend on their website, which might be a more high fidelity or more low fidelity metric. What are your thoughts on asking people straight up their opinions versus trying to infer them like some sort of detective?
It's not perfect. Everybody will tell you, yes, they're going to vote and they're lying. It's extremely unreliable. So I think it depends on what you're trying to get at.
You know, we as data people, we can look at these kinds of numbers and try and make some sense out of them. For the average person who is just reading sort of the aggregation, how do you advise them to trust or not trust, right? Especially given all of these potential flaws. Do you then think that the data collected from these automated systems like website clicks and the like are then better than whatever polling data or what else might be out there?
Yeah, I'm going to answer the second question first. I think it's just a different type of data. I think when you have real observational information about what people are doing, that's, you know, oftentimes much more informative than asking them to do a survey. You can collect that, oh, this person, you know, donates to gun rights organizations. That's a really good indicator of how they feel about that issue. There's also a ton of people who aren't super politically engaged, or maybe they don't have like a big data footprint. Maybe they're really concerned about, you know, not putting all that information out publicly. And so for people who we don't have that type of data on, we have to sort of make inferences and guesses. And that's where there's more uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that was my next question, which is, wow, how much data do you have on people, myself included? You know, I try to keep my footprint low, but then I also know that, you know, my credit cards and everything are all stored in whatever, Amazon and Google. So what data sets do you use that kind of provide you this information? And should people be concerned that mm-hmm. folks like yourself and, you know, other political campaigns and the like have access to these things?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Certainly a topic that has come up more and more in recent years. And I think it's something that, you know, people who do the work that I do and other types of work that's similar, I think the rules about what type of data can be collected and sold and repurposed are going to change and will have to change when that happens. But there's definitely a huge difference between what is allowable in Europe with GDPR and what's allowable in the United States. In the United States, our laws are just very lax. They tend to be, you know, they're not as pro-consumer as things are in under GDPR. So, but right now, I mean, we work with the data that we are able to collect and legally get.
In a lot of cases, people in the financial industry, healthcare industry, folks working with highly sensitive data are really thinking about regulations and sort of compliance issues, all of these things, as they're doing their analyses. What are some strategies that you've seen kind of work to help manage that, especially when, as you're saying, like state by state, there might be different cases, or if you're dealing at like a global level, you know, Europe is going to be different than the US?
Yeah. So I think, you know, navigating different data laws is something that can be challenging. You definitely need a knowledgeable lawyer on your side to make sure you know what the rules are and you play by them. I think it really depends on like what type of information you're dealing with and how sensitive it is. I guess I would say just in sort of my own work, we try to make sure that we're setting up all of our systems to be very secure so that we are thinking about, you know, where are we storing data? What type of data is it? Who has access to it? All of that, which is probably something that like all like professional data people should and are grappling with. And then when it comes to, hey, we're dealing with a particular type of data that's extra sensitive, then needing to figure out like what extra protections we need to put into place to handle that.
Yeah, it sounds like transparency around not only data access, but how it was used is kind of critical.
Again, we talked about surveys and polls versus kind of inferring from citizen behavior. But if I'm trying to predict who Treveni is going to vote for in the upcoming election, best predictor of that's got to be Treveni's voting records in the past election. Is that right? And if so, you can really simplify this by saying, I don't even need that much more data. If you just tell me who you voted for last time, that's a really good predictor of who you're going to vote for this time. Am I correct, or is that naive that that's kind of the building block for how you think about voter behavior?
So yes, past behavior is, you know, the best possible indicator of future behavior. With a public voter file and what information is available, we know which elections people turned out to vote in. We don't know who they voted for. We also don't know if they voted all the way down the ballot. So people vote for the president and the governor, but maybe they skipped their congressional race and their state level race and their, you know, county water board race. So, you know, we have some information, but we don't have a lot. When we're building models to sort of say, okay, this person is like a 99 on the Democratic score. You know, we have all this information about them, or this person is like a 2. But there's a lot of people who are in the middle, and that's actually where elections are won and lost. So the people who are sporadic voters, people who vote, but we don't have a lot of information to be able to say, hey, you're reliably voting one way or the other. And there are people who switch back and forth.
You know, how as a data scientist do you deal with data that doesn't fit what you're expecting to see, right? And not in a way where you're saying, well, this data is just like totally off base, my assumptions were wrong, but more that what we're dealing with is no longer the ground truth. Is that something you handle at the data side, or is that something that you focus on more from the modeling and like building out the product side?
So I guess like when you see results that are surprising to you, the question is, hey, did something go wrong in the analysis? Or is this a genuine surprising result that we can learn from? And so, you know, sometimes you just have to really dig into what you did to make sure that on the front end, everything worked out correctly. And then sometimes you realize, hey, this doesn't make sense, but it's the real answer. And let me go back and investigate more.
For these people who you described are kind of like in the middle, I won't call them the median voter, but I'll call them like a voter on the tipping point. So they could go either way. I think it's interesting to hear you describe them as the kind of the most exciting people for you to model empirically. Thinking about the business world, like who are the people who are most important for me to know well and to act with and to model appropriately in a business setting? because it might not be the person in the middle, right? Like maybe you really want to know the person who loves your software the most and know exactly how much they love your software, because then you can optimize for some other metric. Trevaini, what do you think? Grace, what do you think? If I'm a business, do I really want to focus on kind of that middle person who's hard to model, or do I just want to further investigate the person who I already know a decent amount about?
From a business standpoint, I would see a lot of people focusing on these are the ones who love it and these are the ones who hate it, because those are high value clients to focus on or high value data points to focus on. The ones in the middle, and I'm sure Grace can speak to this, you don't know what mood they were in when you pulled them. You don't know if they were having a bad day or they, you know, whatever happened. So knowing that someone definitely likes a product or definitely hates a product gives you, I think, a more separated data set to work with and less of this wishy-washy stuff in the middle.
Yeah, I guess it just ties back to this ultimate idea of, which is kind of how we started the podcast, of saying, I'm trying to collect this data, but in service of what? So for you guys, it's like, I need to know about the middle voter because I want to switch them because I need more than 50% to win the election. Whereas if you're a business and you're trying to save the world or optimize your money, like whatever you're trying to do, it might be that the 99th percentile consumer.
Yeah. And I think the difference is if you look at this is the electorate and we need to win, you know, a majority or, you know, plurality to be the winner, versus if you're a business, it's just like, hey, let's bring more people into the fold and let's figure out if we could sell at a higher price. There's not this sort of one way to do it.
I wonder if that sense of urgency is a good thing or a bad thing, right? So for you, you're like, we have this day in November where everything's leading up to it. And so to some extent, that strikes me as a positive. So you're motivated to have all your actions, all your ducks in a row and be ready to go. Whereas if I'm a business, I can be like, oh, well, that ad campaign that I want to optimize, like, yeah, we'll get around to it next quarter. You can always kind of push down the line because you're assuming that there's no immediate urgency, which is another interesting distinction between the two.
Yeah, I think, you know, you have the urgency of needing to plan for a specific date. The downside is you have sort of campaigns of specific candidates that, you know, only take place in a short period of time. And then you have sort of more broader long-term movements, and having institutions and ways to sort of build long-term towards, you know, thinking about, hey, let's invest in data, let's invest in people, let's build infrastructure is difficult to do when you have that campaign environment where it's on and off, on and off.
In the article with Taleb and Silver, they talk about 538's methodology and they use Monte Carlo simulations and they have all these fancy statistical methods to come up with results. But I guess a question that's really at the heart of that article to me, and I would love your take on, Grace, is if you're someone who works in the data space and you're presenting results to a broader audience, you know, what advice do you have to those practitioners to convey, you know, these complex and also uncertain ideas to a broader audience?
I think when we talk about polling results and we're sharing that information with other people, one of the pieces that's so important to talk about that often gets glossed over is the margin of error. So, you know, you can have somebody projected as winning the majority, but it's within the margin of error. I think if we look at 2016 and we look at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the collective vote differential there was, it was less than 1% in each state, and it was a total of 77,000-78,000 votes, a very, very small margin. And so while those states voted for Hillary Clinton was projected to be up, but Donald Trump actually won in those states, it's not necessarily even that the polls are wrong. It could just be that you're within the margin of error because these margins are so tight. And then I think the other thing is sort of conveying the fact that the margin of error is just sampling error for that particular poll. So we need to think about what are all of the other messy pieces that underlie it. And those are things that can't really be controlled. So I think just when you're talking about polling and you know, interpreting those results or sort of trying to communicate them, just thinking about this is the best information we have, but keep in mind it's a poll. It's not what is actually going to happen.
Basically, you're saying that we have a role or responsibility to be presenting facts as they are, not an aggregate way that then is easily misconstrued, which I think is sort of the article's, the Taleb's argument is that Nate Silver is not really giving us any information that he thinks he's giving us.
I think also, even more generally, it's interesting because we live in a world where people want concrete answers. And to this point, any prediction that's made you know, there is, as you articulate, there's like a statistically quantifiable margin of error that can kind of be expressed with certainty. That's a little bit wonky, but I think that's valid. And then there's like some uncertainty that you can't even model. But it's funny that we always say, oh, well, it's a 51% chance plus or minus 2%, as opposed to it's a slight difference. But what would happen if we lived in a world where statisticians just said, hey, it's something between 49 and 53%. Would people default and just pick the midpoint? Maybe, but maybe they would come to understand that it's somewhere in there and we don't really know what, and they would get slightly better at dealing with uncertainty.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for today. Grace, it's been really great to have you here, especially to talk about these kinds of questions that are near and dear to my own heart.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
All right, now it's time for that part of the episode where I give you a math riddle. For those of you wondering about the answer from last week's riddle, we've posted that into the show notes, and I'm not going to say it here so I don't spoil it for anyone. But now there's a new riddle on deck, and I think you're going to like this one, Will. This week's riddle is a bit of a brain teaser. So there's a monk who climbs the steps up to the temple every morning, and he has a very specific way he does it. So he goes up halfway of the steps and then waits a minute. Then he goes up 8 more steps. Then he walks down 12 steps, takes one more step up, and then he walks the remaining steps 3 at a time. And those 3 at a time steps he does 9 times. So the question is, how many steps are there?
I have no idea, Trevani.
Well, I mean, you're going to have to like work it out. I don't need to do that.
I'm going to need like at least a month on this one.
That's all we've got for today in the world of banana data. We'll be back with another podcast in 2 weeks. But in the meantime, subscribe to the Banana Data newsletter to read these articles and more like them. We've got links for all the articles we discussed today in the show notes. All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, Trevani.
It's been great, Will. See you next time.